Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I'm going to be your host today. We are interviewing Chris Benson today, and we're going to be talking about self-storage investing with real estate. This is an exciting topic. I don't believe we've actually talked about this topic on this podcast before, so I'm excited to dig in. It's gotten a lot of interesting attention recently and want to find out more about that for all of you. But before we begin, let's talk about Betterment. Are you looking for a better way to invest during market turmoil? Consider Betterment. Betterment is a robo-advisor that uses time-tested principles of modern portfolio theory to help you manage your wealth and reach your financial goals. With Betterment, you don't have to worry about what the market's doing on a day-to-day basis. Instead, Betterment allows you to use the stock market to consistently build wealth. For more information, visit moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. A lot of investors use Betterment, but it doesn't mean it's the right fit for you. Do your own research. Check out moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment to see if Betterment is the right fit for you. So Chris, welcome to the show. How's it going today?
I'm doing great. Appreciate the opportunity, Kirk.
Yeah, well, glad to have you on. I know I mentioned earlier, this is a topic that I don't believe we covered on the show before, and I'm fascinated with it because it doesn't get a lot of headline news necessarily, but I've definitely seen a lot of interest on the institutional side. Can you tell us a little about your background before we begin so our listeners can get to know you a little better?
My corporate career started in business-to-business sales. I had a number of different B2B jobs on the sales side. I moved to a medical device capacity where I was selling medical devices, most recently for a company called Intuitive Surgical. They manufacture the Da Vinci robot. For some of your listeners, they may recognize the Intuitive Surgical as the individual equity because it's been a generational performing type stock for sure. Along the way, Kirk, I made a decision that I was going to grow my passive income stream, and I did that through real estate investing. And so I've been investing in real estate for over 10 years. I started my journey with duplexes and quads in upstate New York, where we lived at the time, and bought a bunch of those and realized very quickly it was very challenging to scale that for what I wanted to do. So we ended up selling those and got into commercial multifamily. We actually built a 64-unit apartment complex out in central New York, and that was really my first foray into commercial real estate. From there, we invested in quite a few multifamily projects around the country, mostly in primary markets, Atlanta, Phoenix, Dallas. And as you know, multifamily has had a fantastic run in the last 10 years. But about 3 years ago, one of the operators that we were investing with essentially said, we're done investing in multifamily until the market cools off. And that kind of was a wake-up call for me to say, maybe I should be looking at other asset classes. And that's how I started digging into self-storage. And what ended up happening was, essentially, I called a number of self-storage operators around the U.S. and said, hey, I got a little bit of equity. I'd like to be able to invest in the asset class. Can I come meet you? So I met a bunch, and I fell in love with the guys at Reliant and their investment platform. And so I was first an investor at Reliant for about 2 years. And then in April of last year, I actually joined Reliant to help on the equity side of the business. So I've had a lot of success raising equity for both our own projects and some of the ones that we were investing with. And so I've brought some of that expertise to Reliant. Just to give your listeners a quick background, Reliant is a commercial self-storage operator. We're located here, and I'm talking to you today from Roswell, Georgia, which is just outside of Atlanta. We're vertically integrated, meaning we buy and manage our own facilities. We're the 25th largest operator in the U.S., so we have 53 properties across 8 states, and our portfolio continues to expand. So hopefully that gave you just a quick snapshot of me and how I got to where I am now.
I appreciate your story because you came from just starting small with duplexes and fourplexes. Can you talk a little bit about your transition to 64-unit properties in central New York? A, why New York? Because I've heard some things about that. But also, I mean, that's a big jump. Can you talk about that transition and how you went through that?
I'd love to say that I had a scientific approach to it and there was a lot of data that was driving my decision. But the answer essentially was, I read it somewhere and I wish I could also give credit. But the quote essentially was, big deals and small deals are the same amount of work. You just make less money on small deals. And so for me, it was, I couldn't scale the duplex, fourplex model. One, I didn't like the people that we were dealing with. And we primarily had class C, B minus type properties. And two, it was just the infrastructure we were going to have to build to scale it was significant. So what ended up happening was I actually called a guy that I had gone to church with as a kid. I'll give him a little plug. His name's Steve Buck. He has a construction company called Buck Construction in Whitesboro, New York. And said, hey, Steve, I'd like to get into commercial multifamily. I got a little bit of money. Can you help? Or what are you thinking? And he said, yeah, funny you called. I just talked to a municipality who's got this piece of land. They'd like to see some Class A apartments go up on it. Let's talk about it. And Kirk, to your point, it was in a town called Rome, New York, which for any of your listeners who know upstate New York, there used to be an Air Force base there. And the Air Force base left in the late 80s and devastated the town. The occupancies were in the high 40s. Rent growth was non-existent. There was no new development going on at all. But what happened was this city made a major, along with the state, major investment in where the Air Force base used to be, and it became a tech park. And there's some big tax incentives for companies to go there. And they ended up doing a really nice job with it and had almost, when we started, almost 6,000 employees who were working on the base, and none of them lived in Rome. You know, you had white collar professionals at the base. None of them lived there because there was no new housing to live in. So if you wanted a Class A apartment, think granite countertops, hardwood floors, stainless steel appliances, essentially there was nowhere to go. So everyone was leaving Rome and driving in. And so that was kind of our hypothesis when we started was, hey, if we build 64, there's got to be enough people who will pay the rent to do that. Because our rents, comparably to what the rest of the market was, we are 30, 40% more than a comparable two-bedroom apartment. And it's worked. It's worked really well. And I give Steve a lot of credit because, Kirk, to answer your question, I was naive is the real answer. It sounded like a great opportunity. I had a wife who was very risk tolerant. And so we said, all right, let's see if we can do that. And it was quite a learning experience.
No, that's great. And I love hearing stories about how people make the transition from zero to one, from not investing in real estate to starting. And then when they scale it up, any business, as we scale it up, you have these challenges. You have these logistical challenges. You've got mental hurdles. There's lots of things that people go through about why they can or can't do something. And I think it's important to recognize that, because I think it would be great to think about how, hey, I'd love to invest in a skyscraper in New York City, but I don't have any experience doing that. And I'd be scared out of my mind trying to do that for the first deal. So I think it's important to just kind of hear about these stories so people recognize that it's not so hard. It's challenging. I think we all recognize that, but it's nice to hear about. So we heard about how you get into self-storage, but why self-storage? You were in commercial real estate. Self-storage is certainly a version of that, but what's different about self-storage than, let's say, multifamily properties?
Well, I think there's a bunch from the operational standpoint, right? That necessarily wasn't the reason I made the decision. So when I thought to myself, hey, I need to be in another asset class, I went to work. I'm a data guy, so I love to look at historical data, and that usually helps me make my decision. So I did what probably most investors would do. I started by looking at historical returns, and I can send you the data set that I use, Kirk, and you can reference it in the show notes. But there's a database, the National Association of REIT Data, NAREIT, which maybe some of your listeners are familiar with. And they have a pretty good data set going back close to 25 years. You can compare all of the REITs and their different asset classes to give you kind of an apples to apples. So when you look at storage in the last 25 years, storage has performed just under 17% a year, which is crazy. Apartments was closer to 13, which is still really strong. But I was really surprised to see that storage had outperformed apartments, because think about multifamily, certainly from the institutional world, that is the sexy asset class, right? Maybe industrial is kind of pushing that out right now, but multifamily has always been a really attractive asset class for institutional money and us as individual investors. So that was my first aha moment. And then the second thing that I always look back to is what happened in the last downturn. I'm a big believer that what's going to happen in the future has already happened. You just have to look back far enough to see it. And for storage, if you look at that same data set, in 2007, 8, and 9, storage lost less than 4% of its value in the REITs, while apartments was closer to 7%, office was in the double digits. And just for a baseline, the S&P 500 during that same three-year period was down over 21%. You know, for me, I saw this asset class that had really strong returns with some downside protection. I think the hypothesis behind the downside protection really is Americans don't get rid of things, right? You catch them on the way up. They have a lot of disposable income. They're buying stuff, and a lot of it ends up in storage. And then when they downsize, you know, maybe to a house, to an apartment, but they don't get rid of their things. And I'm not sure. One of the biggest challenges in our industry is ascertaining storage demand. I'm not sure the why behind it, but Americans just, their demand is inelastic. They want things and aren't willing to give them up even in economic downturns. So those are my two pillars. And then there was a third reason that really kind of cemented it for me was in the marketplace of self-storage, there are six publicly traded companies. And for your listeners who are listening in their car, if you're on a major highway and you look out the window, there's probably a good bet you're going to see one of them next to an off-ramp. CubeSmart Public Storage is the number one self-storage REIT. Extra Space is another one, Life Storage. And then everybody knows U-Haul. They're not a REIT, but they are a publicly traded company. I have a substantial portfolio. Those six companies make up, depending on what data you look at, about 25% of the marketplace. The remaining 75% is owned by companies like us and mom and pop operators. Mom and pop meaning they own one or two facilities. So there's a huge consolidation opportunity in the space for a company like Reliant, where there's a lot of low-hanging fruit opportunities that exist in storage, just like there was in multifamily 10 years ago, but they've been since bought up, most of them. For me, Kirk, that was the big one, was there's a lot of runway to be had in storage on that consolidation play. So those are kind of my three pillars: the returns, the downside protection, and then the market consolidation opportunity.
One thing I started to see around 2010 was I started to hear a lot of chatter from investors. Actually, it was a few Silicon Valley investors, some really wealthy people who had made a lot of money in tech. And they were trying to start a fund to consolidate a lot of the mom and pop outfits. What was interesting to me is there's a lot of mom and pop places out there, right? I mean, you see them everywhere, especially driving upstate New York. You probably see them all over the place. And to me, it seems as though there's obviously opportunity. There's a lot of smart people that are looking to get into the space. And the numbers still are decent when real estate is, I think, arguably a bit overpriced, depending on how you're looking at your metrics. But I would say if real estate is higher now than it was in the bubble, that's probably not a good thing. So I'm a little concerned personally about investing in real estate. But things like self-storage, it's kind of makes me wonder when you think about it. I'm glad you're talking about the recession, because that's an important metric of what's going to happen in the next recession. We're going to have one at some point. We don't know when. We know it's going to happen. And we want our investments to at least be managed risk a little bit so that we know what we're getting into. Now, do you see further upside in this space? Because I don't know if it's been priced in or if it's kind of priced to perfection here, or if you think there's further room for growth.
What's happened in the last 3 years in storage has been pretty substantial around the development cycle. So you can't have an asset class that has done as well as it has without a lot of people jumping in. Our biggest risk right now is new supply coming to market. Just to give you a quick statistic, in 2017 and 2018, the industry has delivered the most new net rentable square footage in the history of the asset class. There's a lot of people who've broke ground on putting new storage facilities up and trying to capture that value. To answer your question about where I think it's going, I don't think the demand will have a fundamental shift. The question will be where the development cycle settles. And so 2019 is supposed to be pretty similar to 18, and then 2020, it's a plateau and stop based on the new projects. But I think for us, at least with what we do, we're trying to do a value add model, Kirk, where we're creating a forced appreciation play in each one of the properties. So we're not betting on the market appreciation. We're betting on net operating income growth, which I'm sure, as you know, and for your listeners who don't, that's how commercial real estate is values. It's income based. So as long as we can produce properties that are growing income, then inherently we should be growing the overall value. Now, if cap rates change, not to get too far in the weeds with you, but if cap rates come up as well, that may affect the value. So what we try to do in our pro formas and how we're trying to project for our investors is essentially were saying cap rates are going to get worse, right? They're going to get bigger or larger, and we're toning down what assumptions we think we can make on revenue growth so that we're basically saying 5 years from now is going to be worse than it is today. Now, you know, maybe we continue this bull run for another 5 years and you and I are wrong. I would guess within the next 2 years we have a correction, but I've been saying that for the last 3 years. So I've been wrong so far. So I think there's definitely opportunity in the asset class. You just have to be really cautious about how you go about pursuing it, because there's been a lot of other people pursuing that value as well.
One thing I find interesting is, are you familiar with the opportunity zones?
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you taking advantage of that new part of the tax code, or is this, you somehow are able to incorporate this, or do these assets even qualify?
They can. We have not done a new deal in an opportunity zone since it was announced. We've certainly looked, you know, how we feel about it. And Kirk, I'm by no means an expert on opportunity zones, but how we feel about it is the inherent property, the project has to stand on its own outside the opportunity zone. If it is in an opportunity zone, what you're going to find is it will be very easy to raise capital for that property. I know quite a few operators who've done some funds that how much money they've raised in a very short time will blow you away. There's a group out of Chicago that did an opportunity zone and they raised over $100 million in less than a day. You know, I think there's opportunities there for sure. For us, we'll continue to underwrite deals, and the opportunity zone isn't really our primary focus. But if the deal stands on its own and happens to be in an opportunity zone, then that's a win. I think the challenge and what you hear with opportunity zone is you have a lot of projects that are getting put out there because they're in an opportunity zone. And the project itself may not have its own inherent value. And the value really is being able to raise the equity because it's in an opportunity zone. And I think that's where it becomes a little bit dangerous. You know, I'd be curious for your feedback, what you've seen with your investors.
The concept is really new. So I've seen a lot of stuff so far, but because it's only 9-10 months old, there's not a lot of history there, right?
Sure.
I've seen a lot of funds raise money, but we're talking about an opportunity zone, which requires you to basically redevelop the property. Well, not much happens in 10 months. I mean, you can do it, but a lot of these larger funds, they raise the capital and then they have to go invest it. And of course, they have a period of time before they have to do that. I've seen there's some funds have had some pretty interesting properties out there they've been able to get a hold of, but time will tell as to the outcome of that. I think the challenge we've seen is a lot of these funds have raised capital and they attach a huge amount of fees to them. So it's just another way to milk a fund for all it's got. And you see these funds and it's a 10-year hold and they're going to charge you carrying costs and they're going to charge you fees and acquisition fees. And at the end of the day, you wonder how the investor's actually going to make money. I'm a big fan of aligning myself with, if we're doing a fund that actually has the investor's best interests aligned and not just how they can make the most money possible from it. A lot of these private REITs that we've seen out there, there are some that are not, but there are a lot that do have that kind of structure, and they're just meant for permanent holds. Even though they tell you they'll sell it in 2 or 3 years, they'll never sell it. And that's okay if you know that going in. Like if you know that this is going to be a hold for a long period of time, that's fine. One of the benefits of real estate is the buy and hold. The challenge is investors think they're going to be in there for 2 years and they're not. That's where I get a little aggravated because it's kind of misleading. Now, with your fund, obviously you're looking to kind of roll up some of these with the acquisitions. Are you looking at this as trading some of these properties if you're able to add enough value and spin them out, or you're just looking to roll them up to take advantage of economies of scale?
Our track record has been built around the churn of the property. We've sold another 21. I said we had 53 in our portfolio. We've sold another 21, and our average hold time on those is just over 3 years. So our investors expect us to have a liquidity event. And, you know, even with the fund we're raising right now, our projected hold time is 6 years. Now, that doesn't mean that we won't have a liquidity event sooner or potentially later, depending on market conditions. But I think you hit the nail right on the head. What you want to know, and I've done a fair amount of investing in, you know, with other operators. And so I've seen a lot of structures. And I think the key that if I could leave anything for your listeners, it's two things. You hit the nail on the head. You want the incentives to be aligned where the investor and the operator make money together. And we have to charge fees, right? We have overhead and you got salaries and you got people. So there's always going to be a fee structure, but it has to be you don't want your operator getting rich on fee structure, because then your incentive is not to deliver. And so for us, and I would say most good operators, the structure is built around, we do well when you do well. If we don't do well, then you get all the money and we walk away. So I think that's a key component. And then the second part that I would leave you with is, real estate is about people running it. What's hard with some of the private REITs is it gets very ambiguous of who you're investing in. The private placements where you're investing in one company, there's a different risk to that for sure, right? Because we're a much riskier bet than one of the REITs, because we got 50 properties. We're a small company with 150 employees. The REITs have thousands of properties and thousands of employees and a lot more capital backing them. But you know what we're investing in and you know us. And I think that's a huge component that I've seen in my career around, usually if you invest in great people, the real estate's got to be good too, but that typically turns out well, even when the property may not do exactly what you want. And unfortunately, the more institutional investments become, the less it's about the people. And that's always been a guiding principle for me. And I would argue should be for every investor, is really knowing who's doing the investing for you, because you put a lot of trust in that relationship with them.
We talk about that a lot. It's doing your own research and doing your diligence on the people as well as the investments. And I think it's understated by most investors. They just don't do that kind of risk management and that kind of research. And that's where we spend a lot of time up front to make sure that we're investing in the right stuff. And you don't get it right 100% of the time. No one does. But you eliminate a huge majority of bad mistakes by doing the research. And we find stuff all the time. We find frauds from time to time that you could easily locate just by doing a little bit of research. And most people don't. I mean, that's why people like Bernie Madoff happen, because people didn't do the research. They trusted somebody without looking it up. I mean, that happens. It's just part of human nature.
Even Google searches.
Yeah.
You'd be amazed what you find if you just Google someone's name and the word fraud after it, or the company. I say this probably benefits us as well, but I can't tell you how many people blindly invest with us without phone calls. It's shocking to me. And I would say you shouldn't. If you can, come visit us. You know, maybe I'm working out of my mom's basement. It's hard for me to understand how some people write checks that are of sizable dollar amounts that maybe get on a phone call with you. So yeah, I'm 100% with you. It's a key component that we try to preach as much as we can.
I'm sure your mom has a nice basement, but I think even the institutional investors do the same thing. It's not just retail investors. I've heard stories. I have some friends who run money. They do managed futures, and they have these big ticket investors. They just drop dollars with them based on their returns. They look at the returns. If the returns are good, they just pump more cash in. The returns start to suffer, they pull it out. They don't even know where these guys work. I mean, these guys more or less work out of their homes because they don't need an office. Like the way they run it, it's pretty clean. But nowadays, you can run virtually, so you don't need 5 million people doing analysis if you're doing a simple system. But I mean, no one asks. They just say, here's a bunch of money, which is scary to me. But
yeah, not too long ago, the University of Michigan Endowment was investing in the guy that had multiple fraudulent accounts because he was friends with the chief investment officer of the endowment. It's shocking to me that somebody didn't say, hey, who is this guy that we're going to give $100 million to?
It's kind of scary. And I think we're actually going to do a whole segment on the show on frauds, because I think it's such a big topic we want to kind of dig into, because it happens. And usually during the good times, it never comes out. But as soon as the market turns sour, that's when these things come out. So I wanted to also ask, self-storage returns. You'd mentioned that you're getting, or not you, but the industry on average is getting higher returns than apartments. But how much of that return is coming from income versus appreciation?
I can't speak to the REIT returns, right? I don't have enough data to tell you that. I can tell you for us, it's both. We've had at Reliant an incredible track record on the 21 properties we've sold. And let me just throw a quick number out to you. I think it speaks to what's happening in the market. So we have 21 properties we've sold. The average project level IRR, net of all fees, is a 45. It's a crazy number. And two things have happened is the cap rates have compressed, to your point about appreciation. So we've had that market tailwind with a lot of money coming into storage, and that's still happening. We're looking at selling looks like it's going to be about 14 properties of our portfolio. And we had the brokers in here giving us their pitch and essentially what they think they can value it at. And they can't tell us. they said, hey, 2 years ago, we could have told you within 1% how much money this portfolio will trade for. Now they give you a range because there's so much capital chasing deals. And some, and I hate to say this, is stupid capital, right? Where people will just throw money at it without what I would consider a reasonable valuation. That may benefit us and our investors, but the last, call it 10 years in storage, there's been a cap rate compression for sure. And so values have grown. I think the good news with us as an operator is our average NOI growth is also very robust, which would suggest that not only is the market helping us, but we're also growing the valuations internally. I think the reason our returns are so robust is because we've had that market tailwind as well. In our fund, Kirk, that we're raising capital for right now, it's about half and half. About half the projected return is coming from cash flow, and the other half is coming from profit at disposition. The difference is when we project profit at disposition, we're saying cap rates are going to be 150 basis points higher than where they are today. So we're being pretty conservative, we believe, over what we think happens. And if they don't go up, then everybody makes a lot more money. But it's hard for us to imagine that. My dad says trees don't grow to the sky. Eventually, something has to stop. I would say that in the last 10 years, storage growth has been really fueled by the amount of capital coming into the space. So really, you have to find your niches where you can create value. It's not just an appreciation play, that you're forcing the appreciation in the property as well.
Great. I appreciate the insight into that. Do you have any final thoughts or anything that you wanted to talk about regards to self-storage that we haven't covered?
You know, the one thing I would say specific to storage, which is an interesting kind of niche, is it's very much a micro market where when we underwrite a deal, what we really care about is the 1, 3, and 5 mile radius around the property. You know, the MSA level data isn't really as important. Because think about storage. It's not something people drive for. You know, an apartment, maybe in a school district that you want your kids to be in, so you'll drive 10, 15 minutes to get there. With storage, it's a garage. So essentially, it's got to be convenient to work or your home. And I think that's the interesting part about the business is even though a market may be oversupplied, let's say we look at Atlanta as an MSA and say, hey, there's been a huge glut of development there. Rent growth is going negative. There's too much supply in the market. But that doesn't mean that's everywhere. And that's what's interesting is it's a sharpshooter's game and you can find little pockets that you still have opportunity in. And I think for us, that's what keeps us excited and our underwriting team, our acquisitions team busy is there's still little pockets where there are opportunities. And that's what we're chasing day by day. So a little bit different than other asset classes.
Appreciate your insight today, Chris. Where can people find more about you and your fund?
If you're interested in learning more about the platform and Reliant, you can go to reliantinvestments.com. We get a bunch of information on the firm and our previous track record. If you go to LinkedIn, and my name's Chris Benson, it's with a K, K-R-I-S-B-E-N-S-O-N. And then we also have an educational website. It's actually at chrisbenson.com, where we did a video series on if I were a new commercial real estate investor, what we would want them to know. So it's not self-storage specific. It's just commercial real estate specific. And it's free. You just put your email address in and you have access to the, I think it's an 8-part video series. Any of those three, I think you could find us if you want to get more information.
Now let's move into the panel portion of our show. Today, we have two returning panelists. We have Megan Gorman. How are you doing, Megan?
Hi, Kirk. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Glad to have you here. Are you back with power yet?
You know what? Luckily, we never lost power last week, which was great. It was just a vicious threat that they had. But luckily, we didn't really have any fires that were significant here. There was one small one.
Well, that's good. And I guess you're missing out on that. What did the governor promise? A few $100 for every person who lost power.
Is that
power?
What he did? Well, it would be nice if he gave us something back. He does tax us quite a bit.
Yeah, he's going to take a lot of your money, but here's $100. That'll make up for it.
Yeah, and in California, that'll go far.
And we also have another returning panelist, Mindy Jensen. How you doing, Mindy?
Kirk, I'm having a great day. How are you doing?
Enjoying my New England fall weather up here. We're in the middle of the peak season for New England fall weather, so it's pretty awesome. Well, great. Well, it was a great interview with Chris earlier. Really enjoyed that. One of the reasons we brought Mindy on, because she's our real estate guru. So, Mindy, what are your thoughts on self-storage investing?
You know, I read an article in a newspaper about 100 years ago that said Americans have so much stuff that they're not willing to part with, but they don't have room for it in their house. So they put it in self-storage. I thought that was very interesting. I look around, and when you try to find a storage unit, you can't. If you're looking for a storage unit, call up a self-storage company near you and they'll either say, I'm sorry, we have no availability, or, you know, I think I've got a unit coming available at the end of the month. Usually you get the no availability. There's just so much money in self-storage and so much demand for self-storage. Every time a new facility opens up, they're instantly full because people have too much stuff that they're not willing to part with. I love the idea of self-storage, and a friend of mine just reached out and said, hey, have you ever thought about investing in it? I'm like, yeah, I've thought about it a lot. He said, well, I'm getting ready to build some and I'll hit you up when I need money. And I'm like, I'm so excited for that because, again, they're just going to be instantly filled.
You say the article was 100 years ago?
Well, you know, give or take, maybe 96. But it was like a full page article in the Chicago Tribune about how people just can't part with their things.
That's a great point. We could certainly talk about it at some future time because I think that's a huge problem we all have. I'm reading an interesting book called Essentialism right now, which kind of gets into that topic of we have too much stuff, whether it's mental baggage or even physical stuff that we can get rid of. It's really fascinating. So what about you, Megan? What are your thoughts on self-storage?
As someone who has a self-storage unit somewhere, I get it. You know, I think Mindy brings up a great point, which is it's one of these things that's everywhere, and we are so attached to our belongings. And it's a good point to bring up right now that as we sort of look ahead, and Jamie Dimon was on the news this week saying, of course, we're going into a recession. You know, things like self-storage is sort of one of those types of investments that if you think about it, can be recession-proof. And I think it's if you look at the statistics out there, what you find is, I think it's one out of every 10 Americans use self-storage. And even in good economies and bad economies, we all sort of are wedded to our stuff. You know, I think the thing is, and maybe it's because I look at this from a planner standpoint, I always have clients looking at things such as, you know, how do I create predictable income streams? How do I make sure that regardless of what happens, I'm not just relying solely on my investment portfolio? Self-storage is an interesting concept for retirement planning because when you actually start to look at the numbers, it's not the big companies that are in this. This tends to be the average individual who invests, and that these types of investments throw off significant cash flow. And if you think about it from a tax standpoint, with depreciation and expenses, you can make this investment cash flow positive, but yet from a tax standpoint, it could be relatively neutral. So I like the idea of it from a very distinct retirement standpoint.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point because I mean, we have a lot of listeners here who are close to or in retirement, and having a consistent cash flow is really important, which is, you know, one of the huge draws of real estate, right? I mean, you've got a lot of investments out there. I mean, you look at dividend stocks and hopefully the dividend stays the same at least or goes up. But, you know, with real estate related investments, you have a captive audience, right?
Right.
You've got property. There's always somebody who needs to rent that. With storage, it seems to be, from what Mindy says, it seems to be more of a human condition. I didn't realize that they had storage like this 100 years ago or 96 years ago. That's amazing to me.
I have to say, I was amazed when she said that. One of the things to keep in mind from a retirement standpoint is, and Kirk, I'm sure you have clients that have rental properties, but most people, when they get into having a rental property, don't often run the numbers to see if it's cash flow positive and where they stand, right? I know so many people who come to me, and when I first look at their rentals, the stories are, well, I still have to put money into it every month. And by the way, they're calling me at 3 a.m. because the toilet stopped up. So I sort of think, you know, this is an interesting concept because it takes some of the day-to-day drama out of it, but is interesting from the fact that it's quite profitable.
You know, you mentioned a topic earlier that Mindy had talked about, which is, you know, people have so much stuff. Like, do you work with your clients with that kind of element? Because it's, you know, when people have that much stuff, there's usually kind of a sign that they need some assistance in kind of working through some of their issues, whether it's in the state or whether it's they're moving. Or have you seen that with clients in the past?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that most people find surprising about financial professionals is that we are technically at the forefront of mental health. And what I mean by that is oftentimes in our workings with clients, we see behaviors that are symptoms of greater issues. 95% of all people just have extra stuff. We're just not used to getting rid of it. But I have seen over the course of my career instances, usually not with clients, but with a family member or a very close friend who has issues with hoarding. You know, it is not uncommon to hear that finally that this issue has gotten to such a point where they've had to go and look at the person and try to help them get rid of stuff. And it's not uncommon for them to have storage units of stuff where they've been hoarding as well as in their home. With this whole idea of holding on to our stuff, some of it is very normal. And then some of it is just signs that there's something deeper going on. And hoarding is a true mental illness. And I think when you're a financial professional, when you see some of this, it should be a sort of warning sign that something deeper is going on. And I don't know if you've seen that, Kirk, in the course of your career.
Oh, yeah. No, I actually have a family member who has hoarding as an issue. So I'm very familiar with that topic. And it's sad because it's obviously there's something going on that's deeper, because why else would you keep all this stuff that is, I mean, it's meaningless really to them. And I think it's there's deeper issues. But to your point, I mean, it brings up the opportunity for us as professionals to really help people, because as you said, we're on the forefront of mental health sometimes. And, you know, I have clients who are, you know, let's say they're older and they're aging and they start to kind of lose it a little bit. It requires us to kind of have these conversations with family members and say, hey, by the way, just letting you know, your mom decided she wanted to move to Costa Rica. She's never been there. She wants to buy a house there. And yeah, I think something's going on there.
Right.
and she has no reason to move to Costa Rica, but some reason she just decided. And I'm like, I think you guys need to step in and have a conversation.
And by the way, it's hard to do that. I mean, it really is, because you're trying to be respectful of people. But when you see these things, like what you just talked about, it's, you have to be the one that brings in help, whether it's alerting other family members. But a lot of times people don't know there are resources out there. I saw this about 2 years ago. A client of mine had to engage for a family member, a firm, and it was run by a psychologist. But part of it was to walk the person through the house and help them start getting rid of their stuff and breaking the emotional connection. Now, that's an extreme, but I was amazed that there's enough people out there with these issues that there's a need for such a business.
Yeah, I actually have a family member, a different family member who does that too.
Well, now that I know that, if I need someone, I'll call you.
I had to put those two family members together, really.
Exactly. It's a good Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting. No, and I appreciate that comment, because I think that's an important thing for a lot of people to think about is, you know, we're talking about self-storage as an investment, but there's a lot of other related areas that come into this. But I want to dig back into this as an investment. So Mindy, a lot of people invest in real estate. They think of real estate as like single family homes or commercial, but self-storage is kind of, I don't know, I don't want to call it a black sheep, but it's kind of a different investment in that area. What kinds of people typically do you see that invest in self-storage? Like, what's a good fit from what you've seen?
Well, it is kind of more than just real estate. It's also a bit of a business. It's not 100% passive, although the typical model is you set up somebody to get a unit and then you have a monthly recurring charge on your credit card. So there's not a ton of business involved in it. There is the initial setup and that's kind of it. But basically, it's for anybody who wants to get a good return. I mean, the money is pretty phenomenal for the amount of work that you're doing on it. I would think it's more passive than a rental property, because you do have to take care of issues. And what are the fixes on a self-storage place? You have to make sure the gate works. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people have their own code. They have their own lock on their unit. If they don't pay, you have to put a different lock on the unit to lock them out until they do pay. But again, most people set up it is a recurring charge on your credit card. You know, I think it's a great investment opportunity. There's a storage facility in my hometown. And when I called the guy up, he said, oh, I don't have a unit there, but I have a unit around the corner. He owns 4 storage facilities in my town, kind of like right next to each other. So he has the same phone number for all of them. And he just finds a unit that's available and they're so close that it doesn't matter. He was making something like $300,000 a year.
Wow.
To do.
Wow.
And with all the units filled up, all you have to do is answer the phone and say, sorry, I don't have anything. Or, you know, yeah, I've got one at the end of the month. So it is a business, but it's an easy business.
Mindy, I think you bring up a really interesting point here. And if we sort of put a tax lens on it, if you think about it, you use the word passive. And I think that what most people have to understand is most people who are involved with real estate, who are not real estate professionals, are typically passive investors. Because to actively participate in real estate requires, per the IRS definition, 750 hours a year of working in the real estate market. You know, I think for anyone who's doing self-storage, you know, as an investment, first of all, I think to your point, it's a great, brilliant cash flow maker, but they have to just make sure they're working with their accountant because they probably are a passive investor. And if they do want to try to be seen as an active real estate investor, then they need to keep a log where they track the 750 hours a year. If you're a realtor and you're doing this, or if you're a real estate professional, it's easy to get that. It's 14 and a half hours a week. But for the average American, and to your point, you know, you're not doing much at a self-storage unit, but changing the locks and, you know, running the credit cards. I don't think most people can meet the 14 and a half hours a week requirements. You know, the one thing to keep in mind is, what is the difference between a passive investor for tax purposes or an active investor? And just keep in mind, you know, if depreciation causes the rental or the investment to be in a loss and you're a passive investor, you can only use the loss up to your gains. Whereas if you're active, you can use the losses up against all of your income.
Oh, that's a really great point. I think I was meaning more passive as it details how much money or how much time you're putting into it. But yeah, that's a really great point. I'm glad you
brought
that
up. Yeah, but I think you nailed it on the tax point. That's the thing. You know, this is not something where you're going to be an active real estate investor.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, unless you're a realtor, unless you are in that industry, you're just a passive investor here.
Yeah. And I think it's important to recognize with any real estate that it is a business in a sense. And a lot of people want to invest passively. And for most people, if you have a rental property, as I'm sure Mindy can tell you many stories, that it's a business. You have to do things. You have to fix toilets. You have to work with renters. You've got lots of stuff. You don't just invest and forget. While there are ways to do that, I mean, Megan, I'm sure there are plenty of ways that you can invest in self-storage in the stock market, right?
I mean, Definitely. I mean, it really depends on how you want to invest. You know, I think that for most people, they might not be able to afford to do the investment in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. So using REITs and other vehicles can be very, very beneficial. I think the thing is, if you are someone who can afford to buy a self-storage facility, it's really key to run the numbers. And then when you're working with your investment professional, that might be what fills out the bucket for REIT in your asset allocation. I don't know about you, Kirk, but when I have clients who do things like this, and I'll tell you, in the high net worth space, this stuff is very common. And we just build it into the asset allocation because we're able to track it. We're able to get an understanding of the income and the yield. And people like that. You know, what I found in working with people over the years is most people enjoy their real estate far more than they ever do their stocks and bonds. And I know that sounds like hard to someone like you and me, Kirk, but there's something about real estate that people really connect with, whether they own something commercial like a self-storage facility, or, you know, they have an apartment complex, or they're even renting a house out. There's just something about real estate. And I think that one of the things that the investment community does on a traditional basis is we sort of look down on it. We tell clients all the time, well, you shouldn't have that much real estate. It should be in the market. I'm a big believer that if clients are comfortable with a type of investment and they understand the risks of something like being invested in a self-storage facility, it warrants investment consideration.
It's a great point, and I'm glad you made it, because certainly with our practice, I take a little different tact in that we're not traditional. So we have a lot of clients with real estate. And I encourage them, if with Mindy, like Mindy's a real estate professional. She does it, I don't want to say necessarily full-time, but in some capacity full-time, right? We have a lot of clients that are real estate investors, and I'm not going to tell them you should invest in tech stocks, because I think that's kind of silly. If they know their profession and they're good at it, then that's where they should invest. You know, who am I to tell them that they're wrong? Diversification's good, but I think what's better is to have a good pool of investments to choose from. What I've found over the years, because we deal with a lot of investors that have certain expertise, whether it's real estate or horses or private company stock, they know their company better than anyone else will, and they're going to know if there's some opportunity there or not. So a lot of what we do with the investments is we're agnostic when it comes to investments, whether it's stock market or outside the stock market. To your point, Megan, like it's important to have that allocation in there, especially people with high net worth, like you need to be able to allocate to these different areas. But we're maybe a little bit different from the industry is that we don't care if it's inside or outside the stock market, because you know we have capabilities to do both. I think it's harder outside the market because you have to go find these individual deals and you have to go find good investment sponsors and good managers. So there's a lot more heavy lifting on our part. You know, like what Mindy was saying, with a person in our town that has four of these units, we've seen a lot of mom and pop self-storage people. Like there's always the U-Hauls that are a little bit different, but there's a lot of mom and pops out there. So one thing I wanted to talk about is, what are some of the risks of this? Because I hear all the bright and sunny futures about like how this is a perfect investment and it's passive, but you know, Mindy, what are some of the challenges that come along with self-storage units that maybe people aren't aware of, but should be?
You know, this is a really great question. I am very pro self-storage, and I don't know of a lot of negatives with it. Obviously, you need to sign a lease with your individual renters. So you've got a 100 unit self-storage place. You probably have 100 different tenants. They could technically all leave at the same time. They're probably not going to, but you're signing a month-to-month rental lease with them. It's not a long-term lease.
I think Mindy's point is there's a lot of positives to this, right? So keep in mind, in any investment, there are going to be pros and cons. I think Mindy makes a good point in the sense that there isn't, in the scheme of things, a lot of negatives here. So you've got obviously risk from a perspective of if the economy goes into a recession and people start trimming their budgets, but not everyone is going to get rid of their self-storage. I think the other risk that's out there is liability. And this is something, you know, you just have to plan for. So if you think about it, right, self-storage units sometimes can attract unsavory characters. They may not be in the best areas of town. Or people could be in there going through their storage unit and fall on your on the grounds that you own. There are risks, but as long as you insure against them and plan for them, you can mitigate a lot of that. And look, anyone who is a business owner is going to be making sure they have the insurance, that people are paying their bills, and that there's security around all the buildings that you own. And so that's the things that I would tell a client to be on watch out for.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Megan, because I think a lot of people, when they're looking at investments, the last thing they look at is liabilities or risks. And I think that's probably the first thing they should look at, right?
Right. And this, when you go and you do this purchase, and Mindy probably sees this all the time, clients probably ask her, do you own it in your own name or do you set up an LLC? And this is where you've got to do some planning before you get in to the purchase, because for a lot of people, owning this through an entity might make a lot of sense, but you've got to make sure you're doing the right entity setup, that you're doing the right filings, that you understand the tax consequences. If a client came to me and said, I want to buy one of these self-storage units, we would build out a process starting from tax planning, the structure planning. How is it going to operate? How are we going to run the numbers? Are we going to have a bookkeeper running the P&L to make it easier? You know, these are the types of setups that allow these investments to do really well. Because if you're going to have a self-storage unit, I'm going to want to know your return on invested capital from an investment standpoint. And if you do it the right way in the setup, you'll be able to answer that question very easily.
Yeah, that's a great point, Megan. What are your thoughts, Mindy?
Well, I want to say thank you for bringing up the insurance and the LLC part, because so many people that I talk to are asking, you know, oh, I should start an LLC, right? Well, if you're investing in a business, I really do think that it should be in your LLC's name instead of your personal name. But people ask me that from a liability standpoint, and insurance is going to be a better choice than just throwing something in an LLC. But you should absolutely be working with your tax professional to make sure that you're setting it up properly and keeping the proper records and all of that. Another thing I wanted to bring up is a lot of people who own self-storage units or facilities don't actually run it themselves. They're not the ones in the office setting up the clients. You need to hire somebody that's really going to take care of your best interest. There's no shortage of people that are looking for a quick buck or looking to be dishonest. And you really need to take care of your employee very well. And, you know, don't give them a reason to keep something off the books, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I remember, I don't know if you guys remember that scene from Breaking Bad when Walt and Skyler were sitting over this pallet of money, this pile of money in a storage unit. I love that scene. That image is just like, you know, grilled into my head. I'm like, oh, how nice would that be? But I imagine there's people out there that are doing things like that, or they're storing things that are not allowed. But one point I want to make on this is that, as with any investment, there are no good or bad investments. There are only good and bad prices. So if you think about self-storage, it's a great investment. I would agree. I think we all kind of agree. Like, it's a great investment for many reasons. But, you know, one of the frustrations I've seen in the stock market side is the valuations. And I can't name names for compliance reasons, but some of the valuations over time have been extremely high. And it's always been a turnoff to me, because while the dividends were pretty decent, I thought that they were overpriced. We always have to be cognizant of the price we're willing to pay for an investment, because regardless of whether it's good or bad, you can always overpay for even a great investment, and then your growth suffers because you're not getting the right numbers. So I think from my standpoint, that would be the big thing I would say is important to consider. But also going back to both Megan and Mindy's points of the liability, I mean, this is a business, and I think if you can do it right, it makes a lot of sense. I guess we're close to wrap it up here. Any final thoughts on this as an investment? Or Mindy, what are your final thoughts here?
I would just say run the numbers. Like you said, it's a real easy to overpay for a great investment. And the self-storage industry is huge. There's a huge amount of upside, but you know, you don't want to pay $1 million for something that's kicking off $1,000 a month. That's not a good investment. That's way overpaying. But I see a lot of people who think, oh, I want to invest, and running the numbers is secondary, and running the numbers should be your primary focus before you put your money into a self-storage unit.
Great. And then where can people find more about you, Mindy?
I am all over biggerpockets.com, and they can reach me by email at mindy@biggerpockets.com.
Great. Thanks a lot, Mindy. And what about you, Megan? What are your final thoughts?
This is a serious investment, so I advise anyone to plan. Get your CPA involved, get an attorney involved to figure out the entity structure. Build the right foundation when you do this type of investment so you're able to reap the rewards. Look, I think it's a great cash flow for someone who's looking for that in retirement. Just be aware of all the potential risks.
Awesome. And where can people find more about you, Megan?
Sure. You can find me at Megan@thewealthintersection.com or www.thewealthintersection.com or on Twitter at Wealth Intersect.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And my name's Kirk Chisholm. I'm a wealth manager at Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can always find me here every week on this show. So that's the show for this week. Thanks for everyone for joining us. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to all our resources, show notes, as well as a lot of our archive shows, which I know a lot of our listeners love. And lastly, please leave a show rating and comments on the podcast app of your choice. So when you subscribe and rate to the show, it allows us to get better access to some of our top guests that we've brought on. And we've got a lot of great guests that are coming up in the near future, which I know you're going to want to hear. So have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.